She went up the stairs to the next landing, but she could still hear the motor. "Have you seen her since you left school?" "No, truthfully, I haven't had much contact with anybody since I left." Faith tried. "Can you think of anyone who might want to hurt her?" "Well, I mean..." Her voice trailed off. "Not to be cruel about it, but she wasn't very well liked." Faith bit back the no shit that wanted to come, asking instead, "Did you know her friend Emma?" "Not really. I saw her with Kayla, but she never said anything to me." She remembered, "Well, sometimes she would stare at me. But you know how it is. If your best friend hates somebody, then you have to hate them too." She seemed to realize how childish that sounded. "God, it was all so desperate when I was in the middle of it. But now I look back and wonder why the heck any of it mattered, you know?" "Yeah," Faith agreed, feeling in her gut that this was a dead end. She had checked flight manifests going in and out of Atlanta for the last week. Ruth Donner's name had not shown up on any airline manifests. "You have my number. Will you call me if you remember anything?" "Of course," Ruth agreed. "Will you let me know if you find her?" "Yes," Faith promised, though updating Ruth Donner wasn't high on her list of priorities. "Thank you." Faith ended the call and tucked her phone into her pants pocket. She went back down the stairs, the scent of burned bone wafting up to meet her. Despite her earlier bravado with Will Trent, she hated being in the morgue. The dead bodies didn't bother her so much as the atmosphere, the industrial processing of death, the cold marble tile that wrapped floor to ceiling to deflect stains, the drains on the floor every 3 feet so that blood and matter could be washed away, the stainless steel gurneys with their big rubber wheels and plastic mattresses. Summer was the medical examiner's peak period, a particularly brutal time of year. Often you would find 10 or 12 bodies stacked in the freezer. They lay there like pieces of meat, waiting to be butchered for clues. The very thought brought an almost unbearable sadness. Pete Hansen was holding up a pile of bloody, wet intestines when Faith walked in. He smiled brightly, giving her his usual greeting.
"The prettiest detective in the building."
She willed her stomach not to heave as he dropped the intestines onto a large scale. Despite being underground, the room was always disgustingly warm in the summer months, the compressor on the freezer pushing heat into the confined space faster than the air conditioning could keep up with it.
"This one was full as a tick,"
Pete mumbled, writing down the number from the scale. Faith had never met a coroner who wasn't eccentric in one way or another, but Pete Hansen was a special kind of freaky. She understood why he'd been divorced 3 times. The perplexing question was how he had found 3 women out there in the world who had agreed to marry him in the first place. He motioned her over.
"I take it there are no breaks if you're gracing me with your presence."
"Nothing yet," she told him, glancing around the morgue. Snoopy, an elderly black man who had assisted Pete for as long as Faith had worked homicide, but whose real name she had still never learned, gave her a nod as he rolled Adam Humphrey's face back along his skull, pressing the skin into the crevices. His bony fingers worked meticulously, and Faith was reminded of the time her mother had made her a Halloween costume, her firm hands smoothing pieces of material onto the butterick pattern. Faith made herself look away, thinking that between this and the heat, there was no way she was going to leave this room without tasting something awful in the back of her throat. "What about you?"
"Same bad luck, I'm afraid."
He took off his gloves and put on a fresh pair.
"Snoopy's covering it up, but I found a pretty bad smack to the right side of Humphrey's head."
"Fatal?"
"No, more of a glancing blow. The scalp remained intact, but it would have made him see stars."
He walked over to a large soup pan with a ladle sticking out of it. She had arrived at the worst part of the autopsy, stomach contents. The smell was vicious, the sort of scent that ate into the lining of your nose and back of your mouth, so that the next day you woke up thinking you had a sore throat.
"Now this,"
Pete said, using a long set of tweezers to hold up what looked like a large crystal of salt.
"This is obviously gristle, common to most fast food hamburgers."
"Obviously," Faith echoed, trying not to be sick.
Think of that the next time you go to McDonald's. Faith was fairly certain she was never going to eat again. I would guess the young man had some type of fast food at least 30 minutes prior to death. The girl had French fries, but seems to have passed on the burger. She said, we didn't find any fast food bags in the trash cans or the house. Then perhaps they ate on the run. Worst possible thing for digestion, by the way. There's a reason why there's an obesity epidemic in this country. Faith wondered if the man had looked in a mirror lately. His gut was so large and round that he looked pregnant under the billows of his surgical gown. Pete asked, how's Will doing?
Trent, she asked. I didn't realize you knew him. He took off his gloves, motioning for Faith to follow him.
Excellent detective. It must be a nice change working with someone who is, shall we say, more cerebral than your usual bunch.
She said, unwilling to pay Will a compliment, even though Pete was right. There were only 3 women in Atlanta Homicide Division. There had been 4 when Faith first got there, but Claire Dunkel, a 30-year veteran, had taken retirement the first week Faith had been on the squad. Her parting advice was, wear a skirt every once in a while, or you'll start to grow testicles. Maybe that's why Faith was having such a hard time gelling with Will Trent. For all his faults, he actually seemed to respect her. He hadn't once drawn a ludicrous connection between Faith's hair color and her mental abilities, nor had he scratched himself repeatedly or spat on the floor, all things Leo Donnelly usually did before his second cup of coffee. Pete untied his surgical gown, revealing a shirt that was of the loud Hawaiian variety. Faith was glad to see that he was wearing shorts. Beneath the gown, the sight of his hairless legs, bare but for the black socks he'd pulled up to his knees, had been alarming.
Horrible situation with your mother, Pete said.
Faith watched him punch the soap dispenser and lather up his hands.
It's one of those cases where just doing my job seems like a lame excuse, isn't it?
Yes, she agreed.
Though I've been in this building for many years, and I've seen a lot of things happening that shouldn't, I certainly wouldn't volunteer any information, but if someone asked me directly, I would feel compelled to tell them the truth.
He smiled at her over his shoulder.
I suppose that would make me what you guys call a rat.
She shrugged.
Will is a good man who had to do a dirty job. I can relate to that.
He pulled a handful of paper towels off the stack and dried his hands as he walked to his office.
Sit,
Pete said, indicating a chair by his desk. Faith sat on the stack of papers in the chair, knowing Pete didn't expect her to move them. What do you have so far?
Nothing of consequence, I'm afraid.
He retrieved a paper bag from the small refrigerator in the corner. Faith concentrated on finding a clean page in her notebook as he took out a sandwich.
The girl was stabbed at least 27 times. I would assume, from angle and trajectory, that the wounds matched the kitchen knife you found at the crime scene. The killer was most likely on his knees, superior to the body when he attacked her.
Faith wrote furiously, knowing he wouldn't pause to let her catch up.
There was bruising around her thighs and some tearing in the vaginal canal. I found traces of cornstarch, which indicates a condom was used, but we can assume from the sperm that the condom tore, as often happens with rough sex. Also, I noted some faint bite marks around the breasts. I would say this was more consistent with consensual sex, though that's really just speculation on my part.
He unwrapped his sandwich and took a bite, chewing with his mouth open as he continued.
You can certainly leave those kinds of marks by raping a woman, but then again, if you were feeling a little eager, and the woman was willing, you could make an argument that the marks were left not by rape, but during a particularly ardent session of lovemaking. I wouldn't be surprised if, after a couple of bottles of tequila and some dancing, the current Mrs. Hansen happily exhibited the same sort of trauma.
She tried not to shudder. The bite marks, too? There was a loud snap as Pete clamped his dentures together, and Faith wrote nonsense words in her notebook, praying he would stop. So you're saying that the girl wasn't raped?
And as I told Agent Trent at the crime scene, there was semen in the crotch of the panties, indicating that after having sex, she put on her underwear and stood up. Now, unless the perpetrator raped her, made her dress and stand up, then chased her down the hall and killed her, then pulled down her panties again, then I would say that she wasn't raped, at least not during the attack. Faith noted this word for word in her notebook. Pete took another bite of his sandwich. Now, as for cause of death, I would say there are three likely candidates. Blunt force trauma, the pierced jugular, and just plain old shock. The nature of the attack was intense. There would have been a cascade effect with the body. There comes a time when the brain and the heart and the organs just throw up their hands and say, "You know what? We can't take this anymore." Faith dutifully recorded his words.
"Which one is your money on?"
He chewed thoughtfully, then laughed. "Well, an armchair coroner might go for the jugular." Faith managed to chuckle, though she had no idea why she was encouraging him. "The jugular was sliced. I would say that, in and of itself, the cut was fatal, but it would have taken time, say 3 to 4 minutes. My official report will reflect the more likely culprit, massive shock."
"Do you think she was conscious during the attack?"
"If the parents ask you that question, I would tell them unequivocally that she was instantly rendered unconscious and felt absolutely no pain."
He took a bag of potato chips out of the paper sack, leaning back in his chair as he opened them.
"Now, the boy, not so much."
"What's your best guess?"
"It jibes with Will's theory. I can't believe how well he reads a crime scene."
Pete popped a potato chip into his mouth, seemingly lost in thoughts of Will Trent's expertise. "Pete?"
"Sorry," he said,
offering her a potato chip. Faith shook her head and he went on.
"I haven't called all my notes, but I think I have a clear picture."
He sat up in the chair and drank from the Dunkin' Donuts cup on his desk.
"Physically, he presents pretty straightforward. I already told you about the head wound. The stab to the chest alone was enough to kill him. I would imagine it was through pure adrenaline that he managed to put up the struggle he did. The knife punctured his right lung. Easy math, we're looking for a left-handed killer. Bypassing the bronchial trunk, we can assume the victim removed the knife, which exacerbated the negative airflow. The lung is vacuum sealed, you see, and a puncture deflates it much as a balloon being pierced by a pin."
Faith had dealt with a victim who died of a collapsed lung before. "So unless he managed to get help, he only had a few minutes."
"Well, here's the funny thing. He would have been panicked. His breathing would have been shallow. When a lung collapses, it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. You gulp for air, and the more you breathe, the worse it gets. I'd say that the panic bought him some extra time."
"What's the cause of death?"
"Manual strangulation."
Faith wrote down the words, underlining them. "So Abigail Campano actually did kill him."
"Exactly."
Pete picked up his sandwich again.
"She killed him right before he died."
The interior of the morgue had spotty cell reception at best. Faith used this as an excuse to leave Pete to finish his lunch by himself. She dialed Will Trent's number as she walked toward the parking garage for some air. Faith needed to tell him about Mary Clark and Ruth Donner. She also wanted to talk about Kayla Alexander some more. The picture she was getting of the girl was not a pretty one. Will's phone rang several times before she was sent a voicemail. "Hi, Will." Call waiting beeped, and she checked the screen, reading the words Cohen, G. Faith put the phone back to her ear, not recognizing the name. "I'm just leaving the morgue and..." Her phone beeped again, and Faith finally realized who was calling. "Call me," she said, then switched the line over. "Hello?" "It's Gabe." His voice sounded far away, though she guessed he was still a tech. "What can I do for you?" He was silent, and she waited him out. Finally, he told her, "I lied to you." Faith stopped walking. "About what?" His voice was so low she had to strain to hear him. "I thought she was younger."
"Who?"
I've got... His words trailed off. I need to show you something. Adam had... I should have shown you before, but I... She started to jog, heading toward the mini. What do you have of Adam's? I had to show you. I can't tell you on the phone. Faith knew that was bullshit, but she also knew that Gabe Cohen was ready to talk. She would dance like a monkey if it got the truth out of him. Where are you?
The dorm.
I can be there in 15 minutes, she said, unlocking the door.
You're coming?
He sounded surprised.
Yes,
she said, switching the phone to her other ear as she put the key in the ignition. Do you want me to stay on the phone with you while I drive over?
I'm okay, he said. I've got to show you this.
She glanced over her shoulder and swerved the mini out of the space so sharply that it squealed up on two wheels. I'll be right there, okay? Just stay right where you are.
Okay.
Faith had never driven so fast in her life. Part of her wondered if Gabe was just stringing her along, but there was always the slim chance that he had something important to tell her. She called Will Trent's cell phone again, leaving another message, telling him to meet her at the dorm. Her heart raced as she blew through red lights, nearly causing a bus to slam into another car, heading into oncoming traffic to whip around construction crews. On campus, she didn't bother to look for legal spaces, again parking the mini in the handicapped section. She flipped down the visor and jumped out of the car. By the time she reached Towers Hall, she was panting from exertion. Faith bent over at the waist, trying to catch her breath. She opened her mouth, taking in big gulps of air, cursing herself for not being in better shape. She let a minute pass, then hit the handicapped plate and headed up the stairs, taking them two at a time. There was the distant thump of music, but the building felt empty. It was the middle of the day, most kids were in class. She trotted past Adam's room, expecting Gabe to be in his own dorm, but the door to 310 was cracked open. Faith pushed the door the rest of the way open, noting that the police tape sealing off the room had been cut. Adam's things had been boxed up. The mattress was bare, the television and game set gone, black fingerprint powder was smeared all around the room where they had dusted for prints. Gabe sat on the bare floor, his back to one of the beds, his book bag beside him. His elbows were on his knees, his head pressed against the cast on his arm. His shoulders shook. Still, Faith could not forget the angry man who had threatened to call security on her yesterday. Was that the real Gabriel Cohen? Or was this crying child closer to his real self? Either way, he had something to tell her. If Faith had to play along with his game to get the information, then that was how it was going to be. She rapped her knuckles lightly on the open door. Gabe? He looked up at her with swollen, red eyes. Fresh tears rolled down his cheeks.
Adam told me she was young, he sobbed. I thought like 14 or something, not 17. The news said that she was 17.
Faith used his book bag to prop open the door before sitting beside him on the floor. Tell me from the beginning, she said, trying to keep her voice calm. Here was proof that Adam had talked to Gabe about Emma.
I'm sorry,
he cried. His lip trembled and he put his head down, hiding his face from her.
I should have told you.
She should have felt sorry for the kid, but all Faith could think was that Emma Campana was somewhere crying too. But there was no one there to comfort her.
I'm sorry, he repeated. I'm so sorry.
Faith asked him, what did you want to tell me? His body shook as he struggled with his emotions.
He met her online. He was on this video website.
Faith felt her heart stop mid-beat.
What sort of website? LD.
Faith had known the answer before he opened his mouth. Learning disabilities. Will Trent's instincts had been right yet again. Gabe told her,
Adam went online with her all the time, like for a year.
You said it was a video site? She asked, wondering what else the kid had been hiding.
Yeah, Gabe answered. A lot of them weren't really good at writing.
What learning disorder did Adam have?
Behavioral stuff. He was homeschooled. He didn't fit in.
Gabe glanced up at her.
You don't think that's why he was killed, do you?
Faith wasn't sure about anything at this point, but she assured him, no, of course not.
She seemed younger than she was, you know?
Faith made sure she understood. That's why you didn't tell me that you knew Adam was seeing Emma? You thought she was underage and you didn't want to get him into trouble? He nodded.
I think he had a car, too.
Faye felt her jaw clench. What kind? What model? He took his time answering, for effect or from genuine emotion, she couldn't tell. It was an old beater some graduate student was transferring to Ireland, and he posted it on the board. Do you remember the student's name?
Farouk? Something like that.
Do you know what the car looked like?
I only saw it once. It was this shitty color blue. It didn't even have air conditioning.
Adam would have had 30 days to register the car with the state, which might explain why they hadn't pulled up anything on the state system. If they could get a description, then they could put it on the wire and have every cop in the city looking for it. Can you remember anything else about it? Did it have a bumper sticker or a cracked windshield or... He turned petulant.
I told you, I only saw it once.
Faith could practically feel the irritation in her voice, like an itch at the back of her throat. She took a deep breath before asking, Why didn't you tell me about the car before? He shrugged again.
I told my girlfriend, Julie, and she said that if Emma's dead, it's my fault for not telling you. She said she never wants to see me again.
Faith guessed that that was what was really bothering him. There was nothing more self-involved than a teenager. She asked, Did you ever meet Emma in person? He shook his head. How about her friend, Kayla Alexander? Blonde girl, very pretty.
I'd never even heard of her until I turned on the news,
Gabe asked.
Do you think I did a bad thing?
Of course not, Faith assured him, hoping she managed to keep the sarcasm out of her voice. Do you know the website Adam and Emma used? He shook his head.
He had it on his laptop, but then his laptop got stolen.
How did it get stolen? Gabe sat up, wiping his eyes with his fist. He left it out at the library when he went to pee, and when he came back, it was gone. Faith was hardly surprised. Adam might as well have put a take-me sign on it. Did you ever see what name he used on the site? Did he use his email address?
I don't think so.
He used the bottom of his shirt to wipe his nose. If you put in your email address, then you get all kinds of trolls for spam and shit. She had assumed as much. Compounding the problem, there were probably 9 billion websites for people with learning disabilities, and those were just the American ones. She reminded him, When you called me, you said you had something to show me. Something that belonged to Adam. Guilt flashed in his eyes, and she realized that the other stuff, the website, the car, the fear about Emma's age, was just preamble to the information that had really compelled him to call her. Faith struggled to keep the urgency out of her tone. Whatever it is that you have, I need to see it. He took his sweet time relenting, making a show of leaning up on his heels so he could dig his hand into the front pocket of his jeans. Slowly, he pulled out several pieces of folded white paper. He explained,
These were slipped under Adam's door last week.
As he unfolded the three pages, all she could think was that between the creases, smudges, and dog-eared corners, the paper had been handled many, many times.
Here, Gabe said, that's all of them.
Faith stared in shock at the three notes he'd spread out on the floor between them. Each page had a single line of bold, block text running horizontally across it. Each line heightened her sense of foreboding. She belongs to me. Rapist, leave her alone. At first, Faith didn't trust herself to speak. Someone had tried to warn Adam Humphrey away from Emma Campano. Someone had been watching them together, knew their habits. The notes were more proof that this was not a spur-of-the-moment abduction. The killer had known some, if not all, of the participants. Gabe had his own concerns.
Are you mad at me?
Faith couldn't answer him. Instead, she gave him back her own question. Did anyone else touch these besides you and Adam? He shook his head. What order did they come in, do you remember? He switched around the last two sheets before she could stop him.
Like that.
Don't touch them again, okay? He nodded. When did the first one come?
Monday last week.
What did Adam say when he got it? Gabe was no longer being emotional about his answers. He seemed almost relieved to be telling her.
First, we were like, you know, it was funny because everything is spelled wrong.
And when the second one came?
It came the next day. We were kind of freaked out. I thought Tommy was doing it.
The asshole doormate.
Was he? No, because I was with Tommy the day Adam got the third note. That was when his computer was stolen, and I was like, what the fuck, is somebody stalking you or what?
Gabe glanced at her, probably looking for confirmation on his theory. Faith gave him none, and he continued.
Adam was pretty freaked out. He said he was going to get a gun.
Faith's instincts told her that Gabe was not blowing smoke. She made her tone deadly serious.
Did he?
Gabe looked back at the notes.
Gabe? He was thinking about it.
Where would he get a gun? She asked, though the answer was obvious. Tech was an urban campus. You could walk 10 blocks in any direction and find meth, coke, prostitutes, and firearms in any combination on any street corner.
Gabe, she prompted, where would Adam get a gun?
Again he remained silent.
Stop screwing around, she warned him. This is not a game.
It was just talk,
he insisted, but he still wouldn't look her in the eye. Faith no longer tried to hide her impatience. She indicated the notes.
Did you report these to campus security?
His chin started to quiver. Tears brimmed in his eyes.
We should have, right? That's what you're saying. It's my fault because Adam wanted to and I told him not to, that he'd get in trouble because of Emma.
He put his head in his hands, shoulders shaking again. She saw how thin he was, how his ribs pressed into the thin t-shirt he wore. Watching him, listening to him cry, Faith realized that she had read Gabe Cohen completely wrong. This was no act on his part. He was genuinely upset, and she had been too focused on the case to notice. His voice cracked.
It's all my fault. That's what Julie said. It's all my fault. And I know you think that, too.
This ends Disc 5. Fractured, Disc 6.
Faith sat there, not knowing what to do. The truth was, she was mad at him, but also at herself. If Faith had been better at her job, she would have spotted this yesterday. The time lost was down to her. Gabe had probably had these notes in his pocket when he challenged her less than 24 hours ago. Blaming him for her own failure would not get them any closer to finding Emma Campano, and right now that was all that mattered. She sat back on her heels, trying to figure out what to do. Faith couldn't tell how fragile the young man was right now. Was he just another teenager caught up in his emotions? Or was he playing up the situation for her attention?
Gabe, she began, I need you to be honest with me. I am being honest.
Faith took a moment, trying to find the best way to phrase her next question.
Is there something else you're not telling me?
He looked up at her. There was suddenly such sadness in his eyes that she had to force herself not to look away.
I can't do anything right.
His life had been turned upside down over the last couple of days, but she knew he was talking about more than that. She told him,
I'm sure that's not true. Adam was my only friend, and he's dead, probably because of me. I promise you that's not true.
He looked away, staring at the bare mattress across from him.
I don't fit in here. Everybody's smarter than me. Everybody's already picking fraternities and hanging out, even Tommy.
Faith wasn't stupid enough to offer Jeremy as his new best friend. She told Gabe, it's hard to adjust to a new school. You'll figure it out eventually.
I really don't think I will, he said,
sounding so sure of himself that Faith could almost hear an alarm going off in her head. She had been so concerned about the information Gabe had withheld that she had lost sight of the fact that he was just a teenager who had been thrown into a very bad situation.
Gabe, Faith began, what's going on with you? I just
need to get some rest. She knew then that he wasn't talking about sleep. He hadn't called her to help Adam. He had called to help himself. And her response had been to push him around like a suspect she was interrogating. She made her voice softer. What are you thinking about doing?
I don't know,
he answered, but he still wouldn't make eye contact with her.
Sometimes I just think that the world would be a better place if I was just gone, you know?
Have you tried anything before? She glanced at his wrists. There were scratch marks that she hadn't noticed before, thin red streaks where the skin had been broken but not punctured. Maybe try to hurt yourself?
I just want to get away from here. I want to go
home, she suggested. He shook his head.
There's nothing there for me. My mom died of cancer 6 years ago. My dad and me.
He shook his head. Faith told him,
I want to help you, Gabe, but you need to be honest with me.
He picked at a tear in his jeans. She saw that his fingernails were chewed to the quick. The cuticles were ragged and torn.
Did Adam buy a gun?
He kept picking at his jeans. He shrugged his shoulders, and she still didn't know whether to believe him. She suggested,
Why don't I call your father?
His eyes widened.
No, don't do that, please. I can't just leave you alone, Gabe.
His eyes filled with tears again. His lips trembled. There was such desperation in his manner that she felt like he had reached into her chest and grabbed her heart with his fist. She could have kicked herself for letting it get to this point. She repeated, I'm not going to leave you alone.
I'll be okay.
Faith felt caught in an untenable position. Gabe was obviously a troubled young man, but he couldn't be her problem right now. She needed to get the threatening notes to the lab to see if there were any usable fingerprints on them. There was a student in Ireland who had sold his car to Adam, a car that had probably been used to transport Emma Campano from the copyright. There were two sets of parents who would identify their dead children tonight. There was a mother and a father on the other side of Atlanta waiting to find out whether or not their daughter was still alive. Faith took out her cell phone and scrolled through her recent calls. Gabe asked,
Are you going to arrest me?
No. Faith pressed the send button on the phone. I'm going to get you some help, and then I have to do my job. She didn't add that she was going to search every item in his room, including the computer he'd let Adam borrow before she left campus. Gabe sat back against the bed, an air of resignation about him. He stared at the mattress opposite. Faith resisted the impulse to reach out and tuck a stray strand of hair behind his ear. Pimples dotted his chin. She could see stubble on his cheek where he had missed a spot shaving.
He was still just a child. A child who was very lost and needed help.
Victor Martinez's secretary answered on the second ring.
Student services. This is Detective Mitchell, she told the woman. I need to speak to the dean immediately.
Chapter 10 Will stood behind Gail and Simon Humphrey as they waited in front of the viewing window. The setup was the sort that was always shown on television and in movies, a simple curtain hung on the other side of the glass. Will would press a button, and the drape would be slowly drawn back, revealing the cleaned-up victim. The sheet would be tucked up to the chin in order to cover the baseball stitches holding together the Y incision. Cue the mother slumping against her husband. But the camera couldn't capture everything. The pungent smell of the morgue, the distant whine of the giant freezers where they stored the bodies, the way the floor seemed to suck at the soles of your shoes as you walked toward that window, the heaviness of your arm as you reached out to push that button. The curtain pulled back. Both parents stood silent, probably numb. Simon was the first to move. He reached out and pressed his hand against the glass. Will wondered if he was remembering what it felt like to hold his son's hand. Was that the sort of thing fathers did? At the park, out in public,
Fathers and sons were always playing ball or tossing frisbees, the only contact between them a rustle of the hair or a punch on the arm. This seemed to be how dads taught their boys to be men. But there had to be a point, maybe early on, when they were able to hold their hands. One tiny one, engulfed by one big one. Adam would have needed help crossing the street. In a crowd, you wouldn't want him to wander off. Yes, Will decided. Simon Humphrey had held his son's hands. Gail turned to Will. She wasn't crying, but he sensed a familiar reserve, a kindred spirit. She would be at the hotel later tonight, maybe in the shower or sitting on the bed while her husband went for a walk. And then she would allow this moment to crash over her. She would be back in front of that window looking at her dead son. She would collapse. She would feel her spirit leaving her body and know it might never return. For now, she said, "Thank you, Agent Trent," and shook his hand. He led them down the hallway, asking them about the hotel where they would stay, giving them advice on where to have supper. He was aware of how foolish the small talk sounded, but Will also knew that the distraction would help them make it through the building, to give them the strength they needed to leave their child in this cold, dark place. They'd rented a car at the airport, and Will went with them as far as the garage. Through the glass panel in the door, he watched Gail Humphrey stumble. Her husband caught her arm, and she shrugged him off. He tried again, and she slapped at him, yelling, until he wrapped his arms around her to make her stop. Will turned away, feeling like an intruder. He took the stairs up the 6 flights to his office. At 8:30, everyone but the skeleton crew had already gone home for the day. The lights were out, but he would have known his way even without the faint glow of the emergency exit signs. Will had a corner office, which would have been impressive if it hadn't been this particular corner. Between the Home Depot across the street and the old Ford factory next door that had been turned into apartment buildings, there wasn't much to look at. Sometimes he convinced himself that the abandoned railroad tracks, with their weeds and discarded hypodermic needles, offered something of a park-like view, but daydreaming only worked during the day. Will turned on his desk lamp and sat down. He hated nighttime on days like this, where there was nothing he could do but catch up on paperwork while he waited for other people to bring him information. There was an expert in Tennessee who specialized in detecting fingerprints on paper. Paper was tricky, and you only got a couple of tries developing prints before the process ruined the evidence. The man was driving down first thing in the morning to look at the notes. The recording of the ransom call was being hand-delivered to the University of Georgia's audiology lab, but the professor had warned them it would take many hours to isolate the sounds. Charlie was working late at the lab trying to process all the evidence they had collected. Tips from the hotline were being followed up on, cops sifting through the pranksters and nutjobs trying to find a viable lead. Will had paperwork to do on all of this, but instead of turning to his computer, he sat back in his chair and stared at his blurred reflection in the dark window. They were coming up on 36 hours since Abigail Campano had come home to find her life turned upside down. 2 people were still dead. 1 girl was still missing. And still, not a single suspect was in sight. He didn't understand the ransom demand. Will was no rookie. He had worked kidnapping cases before. He had worked abduction cases. There were basic tenets to both. Kidnappers wanted money. Abductors wanted sex. He couldn't reconcile the brutal way in which Kayla Alexander had been killed with the phone call this morning demanding $1 million. It just did not add up. Then there was the fight between Abigail and Paul Campano. Angie had been right. Paul was cheating on his wife. Apparently, he liked young blondes, but did that include his own daughter, and possibly Kayla Alexander? Amanda had told Will to get the man's DNA. Maybe she was right, too. Add in Faith, who had managed to get Gabriel Cohen to talk, and that just left Will as the odd man out, literally, because he was the only one who brought absolutely nothing to this case. Will turned back to his desk, knowing that overthinking the problem wouldn't bring him any closer to a solution. His cell phone was laid out on his desk in two pieces. During his fight with Paul, the clamshell had snapped off and the screen had cracked. Will held the lid in place and taped it back onto the phone with several pieces of scotch tape. The phone still worked. When he'd left the Campano house, he'd been able to hold it together in order to check his voicemail. Faith Mitchell's messages had gotten progressively more important, her voice going up in excitement as she told him about the threatening notes Gabe Cohen had kept from them. Will still wasn't sure she had made the right decision about keeping the kid out of the system, but he had to trust her instincts. At least they had more information on the car now, a computer search of graduate students working at the Georgia Tech Research Institute in Ireland had revealed the name Farouk Pansing. After a few phone calls, they had located a cell phone number and woken the man up from what sounded like a very deep sleep. The physics major had given Will a loving description of the blue 1981 Chevy Impala he had left behind. No air conditioning, no seat belts. The driver's door stuck when it rained, the engine leaked like a sieve. The undercarriage was so rusted out that from the back seat you could watch the road pass under your shoes. Because of its age, the state of Georgia considered the car a classic, and it was therefore exempt from any emissions requirements. Farouk had sold the ancient car to Adam Humphrey for $400. The state had no record of Adam ever applying for insurance or a tag. They had issued a new alert on the Impala, but the warning only pertained to the state of Georgia. Emma Campano could easily be in Alabama or Tennessee or the Carolinas. Given the almost 2 days that had passed since her abduction, she could well be in Mexico or Canada. Will's computer gave a chug like a train, indicating that the system was running. Will had been out of the office for 2 days. He needed to check his email and file his daily reports. He put on the headphones and adjusted the microphone, preparing to dictate the report. After opening up a blank Word document, he pressed the start key but found himself at a loss for words. He stopped the recorder and sat back in his chair. When he reached up to rub his eyes, he gasped from the pain. Paul hadn't broken his nose, but he'd managed to whack it hard enough to move the cartilage. With the ransom recording to analyze and the threatening notes to rush to the lab, Will hadn't had time to look at himself in the mirror until about 10 minutes before the Humphreys had shown up to identify their son. Will's nose had been broken several times in the past. It was already crooked enough. With the bruises, he looked like a bar brawler, which did not exactly engender trust in the Humphreys. The father had accepted his mumbled excuse about a rough football game the weekend before, but the mother had looked at him as if he had a giant liar sticker pinned to his head. Will tapped the space bar on his computer and used the mouse to click on the email icon. He slipped the headphones on and listened to his emails. The first three were spam. The second was from Pete Hansen, telling him the basic information Faith had already relayed about the autopsies of Adam Humphrey and Kayla Alexander. The third email was from Amanda Wagner. She had called a press conference for 6:30 the next morning. Will guessed she'd been following the news as closely as he had. Absent anything else to cover, the reporters had started targeting the parents, picking apart their lives, slowly pointing the finger back at the victims. The press would be in for a disappointment if they thought they'd be able to talk to the Campanos tomorrow. Amanda was a master at controlling the press. She would parade out Paul and Abigail for the cameras, but she would do all the talking. Will couldn't think how she would manage to put a muzzle on Paul, but he'd seen her pull too many rabbits out of her hat in the past to worry about logistics. Amanda's email ended curtly. "You are to be in my office directly after the press conference," the computer read. Will gathered she had heard about Paul Campano bashing his face in. Will pressed play again, listening to Amanda's terse message as if he could divine some nuance. The program allowed you to assign different voices to people. Pete sounded like Mickey Mouse. Amanda was Darth Vader. Sitting alone in his dark office, the sound gave Will an involuntary shudder. Then, it gave him an idea. He opened up Pete's email again and selected a different voice to read the text. He went through each option, listening to the nuances. Will realized he was doing this the wrong way. He opened a new email and clicked in the text area, then took out his digital recorder and selected the file that had the kidnapper's voice on it. He held the player up to the microphone and let it dictate the text
Is this the mother?
Then Abigail, stuttering, Yes, this is Emma's mother. Is Emma all right? Can I talk to Emma?
I have your daughter.
What do you want? Tell me how to get Emma back.
I want $1,000,000.
Okay, when, where, just tell me what you want.
I will call you tomorrow at 10:30 a.m. with details.
No, wait, how do I... We'll cut off the recording. Excitement taking hold. Playing back each line, he isolated the kidnapper's sentences and deleted Abigail's. Next, he went through each voice option, searching for one that sounded similar to the kidnapper's. The last one in line was the one he used for Amanda Wagner. His finger hovered over the mouse. He clicked the button. The headphones sent out a foreboding deep voice.
Is this the mother?
Will looked up, sensing he wasn't alone. Faith Mitchell stood in the doorway. He jumped up, yanking off the headphones, as if he had something to be guilty about. I thought you were going home. She walked into his office and sat down. The desk lamp cast her in a harsh light. She looked older than her 33 years. What are you doing? The audio tape of the ransom demand, he began, then figured he could just as easily show her. He picked up his digital recorder and pressed play. This is the audio. Will kept his thumb on the button, listening, along with Faith, to the kidnapper's phone call this morning, Abigail Campano's terrified responses. He stopped it at the same place as before. Now, this is something I just did in my computer. It's got one of those speaking options for lazy people where it reads stuff to you. He moved the mouse over to the start button, saying, I didn't even remember I had it on here. I guess it's some ADA thing. He pulled out the headphone jack so the speakers would play. Ready? She nodded. He pressed play, and the kidnapper's words came out of the computer speakers in the Darth Vader voice.
Is this the mother?
Jesus Christ, she murmured. It's almost exactly the same. I think he must have written the sentences and pre-recorded them coming out of the computer speakers. That's why the sentence construction's so simple there aren't any contractions. Will looked at the computer screen as he repeated them back from memory. I have your daughter. I want $1,000,000. I will call you this time tomorrow with details. He picked up the phone and called Hamish Patel, who was driving the tape up to the University of Georgia in Athens. Hamish sounded as excited as Will felt. He told Will, if you manage to keep your job, you might actually break this case. Will made excuses. He didn't want to think about what Amanda had in store for him tomorrow morning, but he imagined she was concocting a special kind of hell for the agent who had gotten into a fight with the father of a kidnapping victim. The GBI was planning another sex sting at the Atlanta airport. Will might be stuck in a bathroom stall on the B concourse waiting for a married father of three to tap his foot and ask for a blowjob. He rang off with Hamish and told Faith, they're going to check into it. These guys deal with computers and audio enhancement all of the time. I'm sure they would have figured it out in 10 seconds. Saves them 10 seconds, then, she pointed out. I can't help but think where we'd be if I'd been able to get Gabe to talk yesterday. He wasn't ready, Will told her, though there was no way of knowing whether or not that was true. Maybe if you'd pushed him yesterday, he would have gone over the edge without telling us anything. What do you think about the notes? Someone, probably the kidnapper, was trying to warn or threaten Adam. She belongs to me, Faith quoted. That's a pretty definitive statement. It supports the kidnapper knowing Emma, at least. What about the way they were written? Will nodded, as if he knew what she was talking about. That's a good point. What do you think about it? She tapped her finger to her mouth as she considered it. Either the person who wrote them is dyslexic, or they're trying to make it seem like they are. Will felt the glimmer of pride from a few moments ago disappear like a flash of lightning. The notes were misspelled. He had missed an important clue because of his own stupidity. What else had he missed? What other evidence had gone by the wayside because Will couldn't wrap his head around them? Faith asked, Will? He shook his head, not trusting himself to speak. He would have to call Amanda, tell her what he had missed. She had a way of finding out these things on her own. He didn't know how to handle it other than to confess and wait for the axe to fall. Go ahead and say it, Faith told him. It's not like I haven't been wondering. He clasped his hands under the desk, wondering what? Whether or not Emma's involved in this. Will looked down at his hands. He had to swallow past the lump in his throat. It's possible, he admitted. He tried to refocus his attention, using a roundabout question to find out how Faith had arrived at Emma Campano being involved. Kayla certainly knew how to inspire hate in people. But it's a huge leap, don't you think? Kayla was such an awful person. And from the sound of it, Emma was one step up from her lapdog. She might have snapped. You think a 17-year-old girl is capable of doing all this? Killing people? Staging her own kidnapping? That's the question, isn't it? Faith leaned her elbows on his desk. I hate to say this, but considering what Mary Clark said about her, if Emma was dead and Kayla was missing, I would have no problem believing Kayla was in on it. Did Clark's alibi for yesterday check out? She was in class all day, Faith continued. Ruth Donner, the girl who was archenemies with Kayla last year, was out of the state. There aren't any other girls in particular at the school who were Kayla's sworn enemies. I mean, not anyone who stands out from the crowd. What about Gabe Cohen? She pressed her lips together, not answering for a moment. There's no evidence that links him to either of the girls. She added, I think he's told us everything he knows. What about the gun? He mentioned it for a reason, but I checked his book bag and his dorm, top to bottom. If Adam bought a gun, he didn't give it to Gabe. Maybe he kept it in his car. Which means our abductor probably has it. Will pointed out, where was Gabe yesterday when this was all going down? In a class. But it was in one of those huge lecture halls. He didn't have to sign in. The teacher doesn't take attendance. It's a shaky alibi. She paused. Listen, if you think I made a bad call, we can go pick him up right now. Maybe sitting in a jail cell will jog his memory. Will didn't relish the prospect of sweating an 18-year-old kid based on a hunch, especially considering Gabe Cohen's suicidal ideation. He listed the points in Gabe's favor. He doesn't have a car on campus. He doesn't have a place to hide Emma. We have no connection between him and either girl. No motive, no opportunity, no means. I think he's troubled, she said. But I don't think he's capable of this sort of thing. Faith laughed. Of course, if I was good at spotting the ones who had murder in their hearts, I'd be running the world. It was a sentiment Will had often thought himself. What's the school doing with him? Victor says it's a delicate situation, she said. They're really caught in the middle. How so? Do you remember the dozen or so suicides at MIT back in the 90s? Will nodded. The stories of parents suing the university had made national news. The schools have a legal obligation, in loco parentis, she cited, the phrase that basically said the school acted as parents to the students while they were enrolled. Victor's going to recommend to the father that Gabe be committed for psychiatric evaluation. Will couldn't help but notice that she kept using the dean's name. Have him committed? He asked. That seems kind of drastic. They have to be careful. Even if Gabe's just blowing smoke, they have to take him seriously. I doubt Tech will allow him back in without a doctor's assurance that he's okay. She shrugged. Even then, they'll probably make him check in with counselors every day. Will liked the idea of Gabe Cohen being on psychiatric lockdown instead of left out in the world to his own devices. At least this way, he knew how to get his hands on the kid if he wanted to. He said, let's go back to the murders. All right. Kayla was killed by someone who hated her. I can't believe the killer would take that much time with her otherwise. All those stab wounds, pulling down the underwear, pushing up the shirt. Classic debasement and overkill. You don't punch somebody's face off unless you know who they are and despise them for it. He suggested, maybe you're right. Maybe Emma snapped. She would have to kill her best friend. Beat her, stab her, possibly rape her with something that, according to Pete, had a condom on it. Then hit Adam over the head and stab him, then create this hoax for her parents to fall for. She added, and that still doesn't explain the sperm found in Kayla Alexander's vagina.
Or maybe Emma just